You're listening to a Bellingcat Discord server stage talk titled The Role of the Fact Checker. This week we had two guest speakers. Alice Milliken is a seasoned fact checker, lecturer and journalist, most recently having worked at the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. Hannah Ajake is a journalist in her own right and has recently led an impressive initiative to build a network of fact checkers and journalists in Nigeria, together working on digital strategies to fight health misinformation. Both joined us on stage to discuss their roles and what being a fact checker means in the modern digital-first media landscape. You can find links to their respective work in the description of this podcast. The talk was hosted by me, Charlotte Marr, on Friday the 15th of March in the Bellingcat Discord server. Please note when listening to this episode that we did face technical issues in the live event in the Discord server. Those issues are addressed continually throughout the recording. Welcome everyone to today's Bellingcat Stage Talk. I'm really excited to introduce you to not one, but two speakers this week. Alice Milliken is a former colleague of mine at the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. Alice was their lead fact checker for 4 years, ensuring all investigations were up to scratch. Alice also managed their fellowships and was previously a seasoned lecturer of audio and broadcast journalism on the International Journalism Master's course at City University of London. Not only a fact checker, they have previously written for Pink News and Newsweek, among others. Hannah Ajake is a fact-checking force. She's been working with Nigeria's leading newspaper, The Nation, as a journalist and fact-checker. Currently a Journalism Stanford Fellow alongside Bellingcat's lead editor, Owen, Hannah has previously been a Truth Buzz Fellow at the International Center for Journalists, working closely with Africa Check and Nigerian newsrooms to tackle the problem of misinformation. Over the previous 3 years, she's led a project to build collaborations and digital strategies among journalists, fact-checkers, and social media influencers to combat health misinformation, particularly in Nigeria. So pleased to have you both here today. We'll be discussing the role of a fact-checker in today's age of fake news and misinformation, how the role can impact news coverage, and what the purpose of human verification is when AI technologies are starting to offer similar applications. Both Alice and Hannah are first going to provide a little background to their work and what impact they've seen the role have in their respective spaces. As they talk, please put all your questions in the chat and I'll ask them as we move into the Q&A section. It will only be us three on stage during the talk, so please put all of your questions in the chat and I will personally ask them on behalf of you. I'll first pass to you, Alice. Please take the stage and I'm going to mute myself while you talk.
Great, sounds good. Thank you so much, Charlie. And Hannah, it's nice to be sharing this with you. I've been a big fan of everything that Africa Check does for a long time and have been following their work. As Charlie said, I have a background. I've been working as a journalist for about 10 years. Most of that career has been based in the UK. And for the last four and a half years, I've been working for the Bureau of Investigative Journalism as their lead fact checker. And we do fact checking in a very specific way that's different from some other kind of fact checking spaces, like people who do fact checks of presidential candidates or do rolling kind of fact checks of contemporary information or something like Snopes or even something like what Bellingcat does at times to verify information or check information that's already in the public sphere. The type of fact checking that I was responsible for at the Bureau was making sure that the information that we were putting out in through our work was verifiably accurate and could hold up to the test of lawfare that was taken against us by people who didn't want us to be publishing the information that we were publishing, or ensuring that the information that we were publishing could be used by lawyers, by parliamentarians, by other political actors who were hoping to action change on the topics that we were investigating, or for nonprofit organizations or other organizations who were seeking to do the same thing, so that they could know that the work we did was reliable, that they knew that it was airtight when it came to being accurate and verifiable. And obviously there are complex layers of how do you verify that information, what sources are you going to, and how accurate are those core sources, which we can kind of go on to talk about, I'm guessing, through today. But that was pretty much my role at the Bureau. And I came to that through working as a reporter. I have a background in history, and from history kind of came to wanting to bring a bit more of context and a bit more of a well-rounded information landscape to journalism, which I know sounds very kind of elitist and idealistic in some ways. But I think that that was kind of what drew me to journalism, and was the storytelling and bringing more kind of depth and breadth to what was being brought to the table of breaking news and of investigative work. And I had the opportunity to work with the Bureau of Investigative Journalism in this role during the pandemic. And then it kind of took off and took a more holistic approach from then on, where I became the lead within our newsroom to cover that work. And I think that other than the importance of fact-checking to our small nonprofit newsroom around some of the things I already outlined, I think that fact-checking in any form, if, you know, depending, obviously different fact-checkers might be coming from different ideological backgrounds, and that's a whole other complexity that we have to deal with. But fact-checking is obviously becoming more and more nuanced in a lot of different ways as we deal with new technologies, as we deal with new ideologies and new ways of spreading misinformation or disinformation into the public sphere in different ways, or upholding historical narratives that are completely out of date and inaccurate and are based in like cultural understandings of things that we've all grown up with in our frames of reference. There are so many different ways that I think fact-checking can break through a lot of the cacophony of noise that's going on within our current kind of landscape. And that's why it's important to me to have done that work and to kind of continue to push into that area of work. So yeah, that's kind of where that came from for me.
Okay. Okay, thank you so much. Thank you, Alex, for the wonderful introduction about your work and why fact checkers are so important. So basically, my fact checking experience basically relates to working with media partners to amplify the reach of fact checking content. I started my career as a journalist working with the Nation newspaper, the largest newspaper in Nigeria, and I was basically working on investigations and social justice issues. Then I got to work with the International Center for Journalists, starting as a Truthbus Fellow, where I was embedded in the Nigerian newsroom of Africa Check. And I also worked with another newspaper to kind of help fact checkers to amplify the reach of their content. Because one of the issues then is a lot of work goes into fact-checking, and we discover some of those fact-checking were not reaching a lot of people because many people do not consider fact-checking to be interesting. They feel like it is boring. So what I did then was to look for ways through which you can make fact-checking go viral on social media platforms in Nigeria, especially amongst social media users. And what we basically did was to use some digital strategies to kind of repurpose fact-checking so that we can reach out to, we can get some of this fact-checking content to readers and some of the young, especially many of the young audiences on Nigeria social media platform. I did that, and I also did another fellowship with the International Center for Journalists as a night fellow, and that was where we launched Fact Matter Nigeria, and we started with combating disinformation around the COVID-19 pandemic, where we used a unique approach of collaborating with fact checkers, journalists, and also with social media influencers so that they can help produce content, media literacy materials, and also help share some of the content that we produce so they can get more eyeballs. I just quickly want to show like a brief presentation. Okay, maybe like some projects, the election disinformation projects that we did, like our recent project that we did before I resumed as a fellow at Stanford. So what we did was to initiate a fact-checking project, trying to combat disinformation and promoting information integrity and public media literacy, especially relating to the elections on social media platforms. And we work with our partners, Africa Check, The Cable, Dubawa, and these are fact-checking organizations based in Nigeria who did a lot of work to try to combat disinformation on social media platforms. And, you know, initially I mentioned that one of the ways that I led my work is to really see how we can make facts go viral on social media platforms and to see how we can key into pushing fact-checking content in the front of young audiences and underserved audiences. So we invested in media literacy using humor. We did some short comedy videos that we shared among social media influencers with social media users, and we engage influencers to create content tailored towards norm shifting, like trying to get people to learn how to verify information before they share on social media platforms. And one way that we also work to make sure to ensure that fact-checking is much more engaging is to work with some of our media partners to turn their fact-check into short videos. And one way we did that was to use an AI tool to repurpose our content, so that way we can turn text into images and we can also produce like talking head videos. So the fact check are much more interesting. It's not just like, it's just like a bunch of text that is on a website and people get to engage with them. And we also work with training journalists on how they can detect disinformation. And one of the things that was actually unique about our election disinformation project was that the last election in Nigeria kind of saw the use of generative AI, where people were trying to manipulate people, especially by creating videos, by pushing out videos that were created with AI and trying to kind of distort the views of people regarding making informed decisions about the election. So that was something that we did, and we create conversations on disinformation and elections, inviting stakeholders and just getting people who are not usually familiar with fact-checking topic to tuning into these conversations and learn one or two things. And some of the impacts that we saw was that using an approach of trying to reach people or meet people where they are, especially sometimes publishing fact-check in local languages, actually help people to change the way they interact or engage with some of our fact-checking content. We had millions of organic engagements for some of the content that we pushed out, because obviously at that time, we could not even promote fact-checks talking about disinformation relating to the election. So our collaboration with social media influencers and content creators really helped us to reach a lot of people online. So that is basically we did with the election disinformation project, you know. And like I mentioned, the core of my work has been to see how we can push fact checks to reach more people, especially people that may not really be interested in consuming fact checking content because they think it's boring or it's not engaging enough. And currently what I'm working on is to see how we can combat disinformation on encrypted social media, because that is a space where you have like a medium like WhatsApp has been described as the black box for disinformation in Nigeria. And we don't have a lot of fact checkers doing a lot of work in that space. So that is basically what I'm working on, to see how we can combat disinformation on encrypted social media while we continue to reach underserved audiences and younger audiences with fact-checking consent, working and collaborating with media partners and fact-checkers and content creators. Thank you.
Thank you, Hannah, for sharing that. I know a couple of people had issues seeing your screen then. So if you do have any of the links to some of your work, I think it'd be really useful to put it in the chat if that's okay during the next bit. Also, if you have any questions, please put them in the chat as well. I'm monitoring it as we speak. I wanted to start the discussion in terms of the questions on asking you what kind of skill sets are needed to be a fact checker. What kind of requirements did you see in yourselves when getting the roles? But also kind of what are you looking for when you're training others to be fact checkers as well? What's the skill sets that you need to kind of fulfill this role effectively?
Okay, I think it's basically the usual skills that a journalist would need. You know, the curiosity, you want to do investigation, the ability to be able to question things and not just take information at surface value. So those are the basic skills that a fact checker will need, are the basic journalism skills, if you ask me, the basic requirements for you to do your work well as a journalist. But presently these days with, you know, with generative AI and some other technological advancements that are really making it difficult for people to be able to identify for people to be able to differentiate what is real from what is fake. I think it's important for a fact checker to have basic knowledge about using some technological. I'm trying to gather my thoughts. Like maybe using some technological tools, you know, you're talking about being able to do reverse image search, being able to look through documents, being able to use some AI tools to kind of verify if a content has been manipulated or not. And also there's also the normal journalism tool of reaching out to experts, getting hardcore evidence to support your fact checking, and also trying to kind of basically just use modern journalism tool to try to verify the information. So it's basically the tools that you need as a journalist. But these days, you need to get acquainted with some of the new technological tools that will help you do your work better.
Alice, I don't know.
Yeah, I definitely.
You want to add to that?
Yeah, I definitely agree with Hannah. It's a funny thing because I go and lecture with students, and when I taught at City, a lot of students were people who don't necessarily haven't worked in newsrooms where fact checking is kind of a big thing, or they think of fact checking as being this really alien thing. It's, you know, the same with kind of investigative journalism. It's like, ooh, it's this really fancy thing. It's actually just journalism. It's doing kind of boiling things down to the basics of what it is that we are here to do, is to find verifiable information, to inform the public accurately, to try and strip away as much of the bias as we can feasibly do. You know, all these things are ideals, but that's kind of what fact checking exists to do, is to look at the evidence and to say there is evidence for this, there isn't evidence for that, and there might be evidence for this, but it's contested by that, which is, you know, the truth, or is more verifiable or is more factual. So there's definitely that. And then I completely agree with Hannah that there is another level of, you know, and I think Bellingcat does a lot of that work of the OSINT and the human work and the reverse image searching. And again, with the new technologies around image manipulation and the video manipulation and the voice manipulation, and that's a whole other level of verification that needs to start coming into play and is going to become more important for, I think, all journalists to be able to do, not just fact checkers. And I think that that's something that I really try and reinforce when I'm talking about fact checking, is that this isn't something necessarily that is unique. This is something that we want everybody to be able to do, all journalists to be able to practice. And I think there is definitely something for me around encouraging people to check themselves as well as the information that they're working with, because we all come to the work that we do with our own perception of what it is that we're doing, and we can't completely get rid of that. And I think the minute that we slip into trying to have things verify our own opinion or our own feelings about a topic we're covering, then we're starting to enter into dangerous territory. And that's I really encourage all of the training journalists who I work with to, like, you need to be checking your own gut and your own sense of what's happening. And then you can start checking the information that you've gathered. And, you know, then there's the next level of going outside of the information that you are relying on and to see if there is combating information to balance that out.
Yeah, I was actually having this almost exact conversation with the Bellingcat volunteer community yesterday about kind of being that responsible researcher and taking time to fact check your own work before the editorial, the sub-editors or the fact checkers come in and have to do that work for you as well. Alice, just while you're talking, I was just wondering if you could perhaps talk through what you might be doing with a typical investigation. What kinds of steps might you take to make sure that it's properly fact-checked before it's published?
Yeah, I mean, with the Bureau, it's a very unique approach, and it's almost an academic approach, and that's kind of indicative of, I think, our identity as an organization in a lot of ways. And we have the luxury of time because we are solely doing investigations and pretty much on our own schedule. So the process that we do, you know, fact checking is embedded kind of at every level, from the reporters through the editorial team, through the sub editing team, and then me, and then the legal team. And that's a great thing. I think that thread isn't always kind of sewn from the beginning to the end. But the burden of proof is really on the journalists at the Bureau to be providing the information to me or to whoever is fact checking to show us where they got the information that they have. And so that we're not necessarily starting from scratch, which I think is a good thing, because we don't really have the money as a nonprofit to kind of relitigate everything from the beginning, to go and do our own reporting on something and to re-report something for us doesn't actually make sense. And I think probably wouldn't make sense for most newsrooms. But we have the reporters will kind of preserve all of the resources that they've relied on, all of the sources that they've read, into a folder and save everything, and then basically footnote our articles into every single fact from somebody's name, the spelling of their name, their age, if that's relevant, you know, the job that they're working, what color the sky was on a certain date, or what the weather pattern was, or specific spelling of something. Some things are kind of culturally embedded depending on the country we're working in, the dialect of the language. Like, there's so many elements of it, but that's basically what it is really digging down into every single, what might seem like a pedantic minutia of fact, to kind of strip it apart and go, how do you know this? How do you know what you're telling me? Where are you getting that information from? And a lot of the times the joke that I use with a lot of people who I train on this is like, you maybe took biology when you were 14, but you don't know what mitochondria does. You might think you know what mitochondria does. And as journalists, sometimes, you know, when we've got 5 or 6 articles to write a day, according to our employers, you know, we're going to write that into the thing, and it's going to be a half memory, or I kind of remember something, or somebody told me that thing. And so what I do is I really break it down and say, but you have to tell me who told you that. And in some cases we go to the level of, why did they tell you that? What was the reason that person or that organization would have to say that in that way? Because we also have to be taking into account the bias of the sources that we're working with, and whether or not in an article we write according to this person, or we write something about that bias, or we then find another stakeholder in another realm to say, that's one side of this, here's the other side of it. Because, you know, then we also have to boil it down to, like, we aren't really the arbiters of telling people what they should think about something. We are providing the information. And so if something feels fuzzy or something doesn't feel right, or we can't find the verifiable information, either we cut it or we couch it in throwing it back at the source of that information of saying, according to these people or according to this other organization, so that we as an organization aren't perpetuating something that we can't say, we know this for a fact, but we can say this person says that they know it as a fact and we're choosing to amplify that. And that's an editorial decision oftentimes, or it's, you know, it is factually based, but you know, that the verifiable element comes in. You know, if we want to be able to say something, but we ourselves can't say it, then we need to throw it back at a source, and similar for the factual element of it. That's kind of the process that we go through. And that happens, our fact-checking process happens at the very end, after the article has been sub-edited, after it's been through months of work. The editors also know that they need to be on top of this, that they need to be asking the questions of how do you know, which hopefully all good journalistic editors are doing, and hopefully all journalists are doing themselves, to saying, how do I know this? And then we go to our legal team and they do the last level of what can we legally say, which sometimes isn't what we can factually say. And that is always fun. But we definitely at the Bureau, fact drives a lot of our decision making around that kind of work. Legally, we do things in order to not get sued, but the facts kind of drive it.
Yeah, I mean, archiving everything is a basic lesson that I think a lot of early journalists and researchers have to learn quite quickly, particularly when they have to go through those checks that you were talking about. For anybody who is in the stage talk right now, Hannah has just dropped some information about her work in the chat. Thank you so much for doing that, Hannah. And by the way, I am seeing your questions, so I've got a tally of them ready to ask. And Kra Magica has asked a question that actually relates to what I was going to ask you, Hannah, next. You mentioned in your talk that a lot of people see fact-checking as boring. How, especially with the complexity that Alice just went through, how do you convince the general public and the influencers? How do you convince them to spend the time fact-checking and the importance of it? And then Krama Magica said, in terms of making fact-checking viral, you mentioned you used comedy in places. And I was curious on how you weave that in. So perhaps you can talk about how you kind of stress the importance of kind of taking the time to do this kind of work to the general public slash influencers. And then perhaps just expand a little bit on the comedy that you mentioned as perhaps one of the methods to do that.
Thank you very much. So I was trying to say, like, I missed out on some of the things Alice said because I couldn't hear for some time until the last sentence, but I'll go straight to answering the question about how to convince people to kind of see the value in fact-checking. Like I said, because fact-checking was like a new aspect of journalism that many people were not used to. So as at the time when I started working in fact-checking, say like in around 2018, or from like 2015, thereabouts, it was a new form of journalism that many people were not used to in the Nigerian landscape. So what we did was to try to do like some community outreach. So you see, we go to speak in schools, in institutions of learning, and then there are some journalists or some fact checkers who would try to engage people in the community, and also use the legacy media platforms like newspapers and TV to talk about the role that fact checking play in empowering people with information that they can use to make informed decisions, especially about policies and other important life issues. So that was what we were trying to do. And that was why an important aspect of our project was about curating conversations. So we would host live sessions on Twitter, and some other organizations too would host sessions on spaces like Instagram, you know, just to make people familiar, to get people familiar with fact checking. And also working with the influencers, because we noticed that many of the social media influencers have more followers than some of the media organizations that we're working with. So collaborating with influencers and getting them to push out content, trying to try really help us to be able to show our work to reach people that are not usually interested in what fact checking is. And we also work with the influencers to ensure that they become verifiable sources of information. So they are also aware, and they are aware of the need to verify information before they share with their team and followers. And then I'll go back to the issue of using comedy. Like I said, many people would usually engage with journalism topics relating to politics or economy. Then you talk about fact check and you're talking about maybe health or influence operation. You know, many people classify those topics as topics that are kind of niche, like they feel like it is not mainstream. And using comedy was important because when you are doing a media project, you have to look at the context of your country. As at that time, comedy was growing, especially on YouTube. A lot of young Nigerians, content creators, push out short comedy clips that are known as skits. And people usually engage with some of this content. So what we thought to do was to meet people where they are, using the same format. But this time we are telling them, oh, don't be dumb, don't be gullible. You need to verify information before you share. And we just make it much more interesting by getting them to laugh over it, you know, to engage with the content. You know, they laugh, but they also get to learn. So that was the role that comedy played in getting fact check to reach a larger audience base. I hope I was able to answer the question.
Yeah, thank you so much, Hannah. I'm sorry you couldn't hear Alice in their previous answer as well. But yeah, the comedy skits from Nigeria are incredible. And I love the fact that you've used them to kind of push fact-checking narratives. If you have any links to any of the actual influencers that did some of your messaging, it would be great to put them in the chat. Alice, I think this question might be more directed towards you. Sarah says, do you experience frustration when, say, internet commenters want your publication to make sweeping statements and condemnation and don't seem to appreciate nuance? I'm always irritated when I check something carefully and figure out precisely what can be said and verified, and then reactionary commenters want more. Or maybe I'm just cranky. I'd be interested in hearing how you cope if those comments are also frustrating for either of you.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and I saw someone else was talking a bit about maybe wanting information, you know, people misusing information and things not being hard-handed enough and misinterpretation by the public or the information consumer. And it can be challenging. I think it's challenging for all journalists, you know, researchers outside of the field as well, who are doing painstaking work and probably thinking quite hard about how we're wording things and what language we're using and how we're framing it and, you know, all of these things. And we put it out, we think we've done a great job. And then, you know, the peanut from the peanut gallery says, aha, they've proven the complete opposite of what we thought we'd written or how we thought we'd framed it. Or they say we haven't gone hard enough, or, you know, it needed to be more simplistic. And I think it's, you know, I think it's just the challenge of the industry that we work in. I think some of the professional standards that exist within journalism can be challenging for all journalists as well, that, you know, we may want to say things more concisely, and whether it's the company we work for or the values of the industry we work in, or, you know, whether or not we're going to get the pantsuit off of us if we say something one way versus another way. Like, it just, there are decisions that we have to make and choices we have to make as journalists to say things in a certain way. And we're not going to please everyone. There are a lot of people on the planet. There are a lot of people with a lot of opinions, and they're never going to be satisfied, because if your narrative doesn't fit within the narrative that they already have in their frame of reference, then, and they really want that to be validated, we can't supersede that. And it's also not our job to tell people what to think or how to think about things. That is not our role. We can do the best that we can. And I think it's great to hear about some of the ways that Hannah has worked on like meeting the audience where they are to get breakthrough and communicate and say, like, here's the information we need you to hear. We want you to hear. We think that is important for you. Here's how to give you access to information that can further empower you to make choices within your life and within the political sphere that you live within. But we can't, you know, we can't spoon feed the public and say, you know, if we were doing that, we would be feeding into misinformation. If we were saying, this is definitively what this means, and this is how you should think and how you should vote and how you should feel about what's happening around you, that then means that we're doing exactly what people who are manipulating information are doing to spin information in the way that we think people should be experiencing the world, because that's not our job and that shouldn't be what we're doing. And yeah, we probably have opinions and probably have thoughts on what we wish more people would be doing or making decisions about. And we can't control that. And if we start tailoring the work that we do as journalists and drive it in that direction, then we're no better than the trolls who are spinning misinformation into the media sphere.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that more. I mean, it's a question in terms of the way that we word things that the Bellingcat editorial team face every single time we publish an investigation. We're always questioning whether we're mitigating information too much. But it's really important that we're not over promising something, and we're being accurate to the information that we've actually found, especially as we only work with open sources. It's really important that we don't promise that we found all the solutions to a topic or a problem, but display it as something that this is the beginning of the investigation and we're inviting you to take it further. So that's something that at Bellingcat we're thinking about all the time. And I noted that Subtle Knife said, do you feel maybe we are sometimes too careful and more strong wording in Nesri? I think you kind of answered that, Alice, in your response. I just wanted to note, Alice, your microphone on my side went very loud in your response there. It was absolutely fine, but you might just want to move away from your mic slightly, because I think it's just breaking slightly. We've got so many more questions in the chat, so please keep them coming in. It's great to see them. Lake of Constance has a great question, and I'd be really interested to hear what both of you have at the top of your mind. Lake of Constance asks, as fact checkers, which fake news stories / conspiracy theories do you personally find most memorable? Which ones have kind of kept in your brains and maybe plagued you for a while as you're trying to fight back against them?
Okay, I think some of the ones that are quite memorable that I can remember easily with some of the fact check relating, some of the disinformation relating to the election, the last election in Nigeria, where people manipulated a video showing Hollywood celebrities, that is actors, some of the core Hollywood actors supporting a presidential candidate. They were carrying placards saying, oh, this is our guy, this is who we want to select in office. And the people who amplified that information were people that you look at, like where people who had a lot of followers in the society, you know, like one of the major, one of the biggest names in entertainment. And then I was wondering, like, how come people allow some of their bias so much so that you can share an information that you should know that this can't be possible? But because, you know, there's a lot of other things involved, there's the ethnic side, the tribal allegiance, and people would push that kind of information, not minding their own reputation or their own credibility. So that was like one of the fact check, one of the disinformation. And some other ones that I would remember was relating to the COVID-19 pandemic, where people were talking about Bill Gates being responsible, you know, and they were pushing the narrative that the COVID-19 pandemic was not real. They're just trying to reduce the population of the world, especially the population of developing countries, because the Western world is threatened by the advancements of, you know, maybe some countries in Africa because of, you know, how the population is growing. So COVID-19 is like an invention or something that was invented from a lab to kind of reduce the population of people. And some other conspiracy theories also related to the vaccine, especially relating to women's reproductive health. They claim that the vaccine would make women to be infertile. They won't be able to bear children. And that really resonated in our society, especially in the northern part of the country, where some community leaders claim that, you know, if people take the COVID vaccine, they won't, especially women, they won't be able to bear more children. It will make them to be infertile. And, you know, some of this conspiracy theories pushing the claim that the vaccine would actually, the aim of the vaccine is not just to cure COVID, but also to reduce the fertility of women in the northern part of the country. And that was a narrative that was pushed by religious leaders across the various parts of Nigeria. So those are some of the conspiracy theories that I remember that really made the round on social media and even outside social media in my country.
Hannah, thank you so much for sharing that. When policymakers and kind of cultural leaders amplify misinformation as well, it can be so, so difficult to disprove it. We've seen that time and time again when leading politicians and leading figures the biggest issue for Bellingcat has always been, well, not the biggest issue, but one of the biggest issues that Bellingcat's faced when tackling misinformation is when state actors are the ones sharing it, are the ones amplifying it, because it's very difficult to get people to, often to get people to question figures and leaders that they perhaps voted in or perhaps they see as trustworthy in general. And as a matter of fact, it's very difficult as a journalist or as a researcher to kind of present the facts in those cases. So thank you so much for sharing. Alice, feel free to try speaking again. I'm sorry about the issue there. I can hear you.
In my attempt to not blow out the microphone, I think I completely messed everything up. So I was just kind of reiterating what you, Charlie, said in the chat, as well as, you know, what Hannah presented around, you know, COVID being a really interesting and quite kind of stark recent example for the world about COVID-19 and the misinformation that was kind of spread around that. And I think it was interesting to see how much context was kind of brought into that, of like how that led to how it did. I think also looking at the amount of money being funneled into misinformation campaigns across the world and on the African continent. And we did quite a few investigations into specific kind of pockets of misinformation that were going on around it during COVID at the Bureau, of one, you know, different influencers in India who were peddling certain things. And it was quite fascinating. And I think it tapped into a lot of really important things around imperialist histories, around actual atrocities of medical apartheid that happened across the world, as well as abuse of people through medicine from Western cultures. And, you know, it threw up so much of like things that we actually do need to look at and understand of why
it wasn't just that there was misinformation, that people were distrustful, but there were potentially even reasons behind that. And understanding those reasons, I think, are so essential to really understanding why misinformation can kind of take hold in the way that it can in communities. And so going back to kind of what someone brought up, should we be more stark in what we're saying and more declarative? We can't necessarily cut through a lot of those historical elements that are underpinning the reason why people want to believe certain things or feel comfort in believing certain things. And so that's just kind of one thing around that definitely kind of came up for me. And again, as a history nerd, I think that really tickled some sensorial stuff in me. But there's also kind of funny misinformation things that you don't really think of being misinformation, that are just little untruths that get spread through pop culture. That I think one that I remember getting debunked in front of a bunch of people about was like that urine can treat a jellyfish sting, which was a piece of misinformation that was perpetuated through the show Friends. And thinking about, like, yeah, maybe it's quite benign, but then you think about how much in pop culture are these just kind of write-off things that get put into scripts or get put into nonfiction books, which, by the way, most of which are not fact-checked. So you're reading these things and giving them authority, and depending on your education background, depending on what you find to be important or relevant, depending on even your media literacy, that these little things get kind of implanted across. And I think influencers is a really good example of that, that, you know, this giving over of trust to, you know, Susie652, and whether or not the product that they're using is reliable, or whether or not the diet culture is being perpetuated through whatever, and not understanding, like, money is behind this stuff. They aren't an independent actor. They maybe do have an agenda that is financially driven, just like the media does, but we're entering this whole new field of information influence and of young people and of pop culture in a new way. And I don't, you know, you had mentioned kind of the AI versus human kind of thing. And I think this is we are so far behind in our understanding of what technology is capable of at this point. I think as a journalistic industry, I think we're really pushing against a tidal wave that we are not quite fully literate in yet. And we have to work faster and kind of harder to be able to circumvent that and probably bring people in who have been working for these tech companies to understand a lot of how this media influence and technology influence is coming in and changing and shaping people's opinions about what's happening to them and what's happening in the world. Because as someone just pointed out, we've got some pretty fun elections coming up, both in the United States, where I'm from, and across the world. And it's going to be, we didn't learn our lesson from 2016. And there was a lot of kind of like, we're going to look at ourselves as an industry. And then COVID came along, and who knows whether or not we'd actually do that, but I don't think we actually did take a good look at ourselves.
Yeah, thank you so much for noting that. I want to get onto elections and a couple of the questions coming out now, but you mentioned AI and you mentioned the risk of AI, but AI is also a tool potentially for fact checkers as well. I personally have been using Google's new fact checker search tool. I've been experimenting with it, where you can kind of search very easily for kind of verifiable fact-checked information on a person or a topic. And somebody else in the chat has asked, Geo Confirmed has asked, I recently attended a presentation for journalists on how AI can play a role in journalism. During the session, a lecturer from a university or college expressed concerns about AI being a significant threat. For example, a piece of disinformation or a photo that's widely shared or circulated online. A fact checker writes an article thoroughly supported by evidence about the true story, including the correct photos. Then the AI may interpret the story as disinformation because it does not meet the norm known to the AI. This is kind of tied into the question I was going to ask on this. Is these kind of AI tools to kind of help fact checkers, are they a hindrance or are they useful? And I know both of you will probably have interesting answers to that.
Do you mind if I go first, Hannah? So I've recently actually been talking with a couple of developers who are looking into a way of how do we do this? Because yeah, I think AI is a tool, but like the internet, we need to treat it like a tool, like social media, we need to treat it like a tool. And I think we have a unique moment right now to finally treat some piece of technology actually as a tool, because we know, we've seen what happened over the last 24 years of having an internet we didn't understand as a media or as journalistic outlets, of, you know, not paywalling and then having to paywall all the things that we can go into that are boring and fascinating at the same time. But I think for newsrooms to automatically pick up AI and go, great, we can fire 50 people because now we have a piece of tech that can do it, is a huge mistake. Humans are also infallible, humans are not infallible, just like the AI technology isn't infallible. So there is going to continue to be kind of tweaking happening around, you know, what, how do you identify a fact? How do you verify a fact? I personally don't think that using open source AI to fact check is doable because of the example that person gave, which is, if you have a piece of open AI that's using open source internet information, you have to think it's scraping all information. So it's going to be looking across all of the internet. And so all of the internet has misinformation, has disinformation, and has false everything in it. So if you're not guiding the AI to what it should be looking at and helping build it to understand this is good information, verifiable, reliable information, and this isn't, also that boils down to a human being to do that, then you're going to be getting a piece of AI that's looking at everything and going, well, a majority of people are saying that this is true. And so then the AI is going to be going, this is accurate. And when you look at it, it's going to be showing the opposite. I mean, a lot of people on this server probably know that Google changed its algorithm about a year ago, where it's not the most accurate results to your search. It is the most popular results to your search that you are now going to get at the top of a Google search, which pretty much means that we are getting results of who's popular and what ideas are the most popular in the region that we're in. And it's perpetuating the bubble, and it's making it harder for journalists to use Google to do the research we need to do. And it's also making it harder for there to be more variety in the information. So it's no longer who's paying to get the highest hits. It's who's most popular, who's generating the most clicks to be able to get the highest hits on Google. And so if you know, ChatGPT or another open source AI is looking at those same Google results, it's going to be based on popularity. And so if, you know, 65 people are looking at, you know, did Kate Middleton get a BBL, and you're getting all these articles about that, then the open source AI is going to be like, yeah, of course she did, because everyone's writing these articles saying that that's what happened. And so I think it's looking at kind of, I think it's going to be really expensive for a while to get good AI to be able to help journalists with fact checking. It's going to take a lot of time. It's going to take figuring that out. And it's going to take investment from newsrooms. And I think that's going to be where we start to run into big issues, because newsrooms don't want to be spending money on people, much less on technology that works. And there has to be a willingness to kind of invest in good tech to be able to do good work. And I think that's where that kind of tension is going to be coming up. That being said, I think use AI as a tool. Do not copy and paste what it tells you to write. Do not copy and paste what it tells you is the result to a search. Use the same tools that you have used for your entire career as a journalist and verify that information, and correct that information where it needs to be corrected.
Okay, I'd just like to just quickly add to what Alice said about, you know, AI perpetuating the bubble and the need for journalists or fact checkers not to totally rely on AI. I believe and I agree that you just use it as a tool for brainstorming, or you just use it as a tool to help you do your work faster, maybe like transcription. or something. And particularly for African journalists, there is a limitation, or African fact checkers, there's a limitation to which we can use AI. Of course, we know how some of those models are built, the machine learning and the language models that are used. And sometimes we find out that relying on AI, you may lose out on like the context of the issue that you're trying, or the research that you're trying to do. So it's totally unreliable in that aspect, because even when you use like some AI translation tools, you find out that it's not really accurate. And you can really understand, because it's technology built in the West, built by the West. So it's not like the model is really built in a way that it's mixed for like cultural diversity or some of the cultural nuances. So there's a limitation with which fact checkers should approach the use of AI in their work. Of course, use it to make the process faster, but you still need to go back to doing research the same way, you know, using the basic tools that we've been using, trying to reach out to people. Even if you use open source tools, or you're trying to use some verification tools. So usually with AI, I think there is a limitation, even though it offers a lot of opportunities, but we can't really pursue our work as fact checkers totally dependent on AI. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done, especially in the area of inclusion and diversity for contexts that are outside the Western book.
Thanks so much for sharing that. We've only got literally 4 minutes, so I want to make sure that we have spoken about elections, because a lot of the questions have been focused on that. And it is election year after all. Somebody mentioned that there's South African elections, there are elections in the US, there's elections absolutely everywhere this year. And obviously disinformation and the role of a fact checker comes in with all of that. What do you see, where do you see the most disinformation coming from, was the question by Eric Weiss on the South African elections. Where do you see the most disinformation coming from when it comes to elections? Hannah, you mentioned that you'd covered the Nigerian elections as well. Where do you find the most disinformation comes from? And can we keep the answers quite short so that we can have one more before we wrap? Thank you.
So the most disinformation would come from social media, and they would be perpetrated by state actors or politicians who have people, maybe they have like a troll army or troll farm. In Nigeria, you have the example that we saw where politicians hire young people, you know, keep them in a place to trend certain hashtags just to give an impression that, oh, this is a trending issue that people should pay attention to. So it will be from social media, and it will be in the form of disinformation that are promoted by state actors using people that you'd want to consider as random social media users. So you really need to be aware of trending topics. Just check to see if it's an issue that is trending organically, or it is something that is manipulated just to deceive people and try to compromise their views and opinion about the election.
Don't have a whole lot to add to that, so I'll let Hannah be the authority in that one.
Okay, great. Sorry, Hannah. Do you want to say anything?
Okay, I don't know if I, you know, just to ask, you know, just also to look out for instances of generative AI, which we kind of witnessed, and it was funny then. And also beware that politicians will come back to say, oh, to use this thing about the liar's dividend, where even where in a case where you have verified information, they can tell you this is not real, this has been manipulated by AI. So that is something that you need to prepare for, and prepare how you need to respond to that.
I wanted to wrap by asking this question, because we've spoken a lot about the onus on individuals, on the public, and the onus on individual journalists to kind of make sure that their work is fact-checked. But what can newsrooms and organizations as a whole do to become a little bit more transparent, a little bit easier to fact-check? And is having a fact checker role in a newsroom something that everyone, every organization should be striving for, in your opinion?
I mean, I don't know. I think it's a culture thing. It's a newsroom culture element that if it's, because I've worked in a few different organizations, including CNN and Newsweek, and also experiencing other people who I've worked with at the Bureau who have worked in other newsrooms across the UK and across the world. And we work also with reporting partners, et cetera. And it's really interesting to work with people who are outside of kind of our newsroom bubble when we're first fact-checking their work. And initially, there's a lot of resistance. There's a lot of pride in what journalists do. And fact-checkers, by the way, are journalists. And there's a little bit of like, oh, who do you think you are? Like, how dare you question my authority as a person who has been doing this work? And so I think it's definitely the responsibility of newsrooms. It's a responsibility of corporate level stuff as well, which is a whole other conversation. But I do think that like what editors can do and what chief editors can do within the journalistic bubble within a news organization is to reinforce the importance from top to bottom of verification and of saying like, you should be able to say when you don't think something you're working on is accurate and is correct. And very early on in my career, I almost libeled myself because I was a junior reporter and didn't realize that I could tell my editors that I didn't think that something that I was writing was true. May or may not be why I became a fact checker. I don't know. But I think that that's something that's, it is an ethos that has to be actually tangible on the ground at every layer of a news organization, that facts over corporate bias, over financial gain, over even a story that you've put a lot of money into, if there's an issue with the core facts, you need to blow it. You need to kill the story, you need to figure out a new approach. And that I think is crucial, because it shouldn't boil down to only having a fact checker who everything kind of the buck stops with them. I don't know if it makes sense for newsrooms to have like a fact checker. I think that as both Hannah and I pointed out, a lot of journalists can do fact checking. I think it's about having a process in place so that, you know, before I came on board at the Bureau, the journalists, the reporters fact checked each other. And that is doable. It doesn't necessarily have to be like a privileged specific role within a newsroom, I don't think. I mean, probably would have been out of a job for a while if it didn't exist. But I don't know that newsrooms kind of can argue that for themselves to create a new role with a new salary. But it's potentially about working with people like Hannah and myself and other people who've been working in the fact-checking field to understand what are these structures that need to come in and exist to hold the work that journalists are doing to do that. So that might be one way forward.
Yeah, I think for some digital news outlets in Nigeria, you have a situation where you have fact-checking desks. So you have like one or two people committed to doing a deep dive of maybe any trending disinformation, or sometimes trying to fact-check reports or going through the reports of their colleagues and everything and some other things. But what I really like to kind of, you know, emphasize is that newsroom need to invest in training journalists to be able to not just apply, you know, do basic research or fact check, but also to be able to use digital tools, because I feel like the ability to use digital verification tools is not something that many journalists are quite acquainted with, especially when you now go to maybe using like open source intelligence tools. Like, it's quite technical. So I think newsrooms need to invest in journalists being able to use these tools to do their work better. So that would be one of my suggestions and recommendation.
Ah, you just made it really easy for me to advertise the fact that the Bellingcat does offer newsrooms and individuals in the general public training on all open source intelligence tools and resources. We actually have some YouTube videos out at the moment on YouTube teaching some of these toolkits as well. So please do check those out. Thank you so much, Hannah and Alice, for joining us today. It's been so fascinating, the conversation. I wish we had a whole other hour to dig into this. But thank you so much for your patience, especially with the tech issues as well. I apologize about that. I will be contacting Discord with an angry letter at the end of this. Thank you so much for everybody who's joined and for the fascinating questions as well in the chat. The next stage talk will be in 2 weeks' time, not next week. So please be aware of that. Thank you so much, everybody. And thank you, Hannah. Thank you, Alice.
Thank you so much, Charlie, for having us.
Thank you for listening to the Stage Talk. If you'd like to catch a Stage Talk live where you can ask the guest questions, join the Bellingcat Discord server by visiting www.discord.gg/Bellingcat. The music you've heard is titled Dawn by Newer Self and is courtesy of Artlist.